Buddhist Summer School, Tuesday morning, 5th September 1978. Imagine this morning, we are all philanthropists. Just as the real meaning of the word philosopher is one who loves wisdom, philo, sophia. Philanthropists, philo, anthropos, is a lover of man, of mankind. That is its root meaning. We know the ordinary secondary meanings of philanthropist. But imagine this morning that we are philanthropists, lovers of mankind. And imagine it not merely with the activity of the brain, but also feel it with the heart. Sense it very, very deeply in inner consciousness. We talk of the unity of life, but we do not live up to it at all. That is fundamentally because we are not true philanthropists. And from mankind extend the feeling to the whole world. What is the implication here? We reject nothing whatsoever. The things we call evil, the people who are terrible monsters, or whatever it is, they are all included in this spirit of philanthropy. And it remains an actual fact in our lives and inner consciousness. You will see that this is a modern way of expressing the Brahma Viharas of Buddhist teaching. Feel its application in our immediate everyday life. How easily aversion arises. So, let us imagine very strongly, creatively, that we are philanthropists. Through the experience, the knowledge that we are parts of a whole, not only parts of a whole, but also that each of us has the whole as his basis. Through that experience meaning inward realization in consciousness, not merely the outward form of the experience, we are awakened to reality, we are awakened into a state of freedom, of an inward freedom which is independent of the external circumstances. The external circumstances may be harsh, may be very binding, frustrating, limiting. But if we realize that we are integral parts and parcel of a whole which is our continual basis, then there is this inner freedom. And freedom can be painful. It can be very pleasant. Freedom can be very restrictive. If it is true inner freedom, then we do not kick against what appears to us as a frustrating element, as an inhibiting element in our lives. This inner freedom is one of the deep meanings of what the Buddha called upekkha, this imperturbability, this perfect balance within oneself, this inward poise, which often, more often than not, needs the limitations of restraint upon us. And then we will realize that true freedom emerges, flowers out at the peak of self-restraint, the right sort of self-restraint, not repression, suppression, which is unintelligent, but through seeing the truth of things, really seeing the truth, then we are restrained in the right sense. We are tamed and trained. You know how the Buddha was called the tamer of men. And you know, in the Christian teaching of blessed are the meek, the word meek, the Greek praos, really means the tamed one, the trained one. It used to be applied to what happened with the wild colts or asses in Palestine in the old days. When the wild creature was tamed and trained, the word praos was used in connection with that creature. He was the meek one. Tamed and trained. And he really is the free one. Now the word money, the jewel, Om Mani Padme Hum, has been poetically expressed as the dewdrop in the lotus. And you know that lovely sentence with which Edwin Arnold ended his Light of Asia. The dewdrop slips into the shining sea. But from the Buddhist point of view, instead of saying the dewdrop slips into the shining sea, the Buddhist conception of ultimate realization is more a case of the sea slips into the dewdrop. And the dewdrop is the shining dewdrop in that ocean which is already light. See, if we apply that to ourselves, we shall have extraordinary revelation. A revelation which sweeps us clean of all egoism and all personal vanity. And it is more correct to say the sea slips into the shining dewdrop, because it is the universe that becomes conscious in the individual and through the individual. See, we have often talked about this in our meetings, that it is not you or I who becomes enlightened or conscious in the supreme sense, or realizes the condition of cessation, nirvana, or whatever it is. It is the totality which through us human beings comes to enlightenment, not you or I. You or I understood as the limited you or I, the external shell. But when that external shell has become the perfect living apparatus, the vehicle, the Holy Grail, then the universe has come to fruition. And the gods and the angels in heaven laugh for joy, and so do the demons of hell. These are mysteries, if you like, but they become quite clear when one has begun even to see reality, to see the truth. Thus, there is completeness, wholeness, holiness. Then there is no separation between the individual and the entire universe. What is there then? Then there is love. In its truest sense, the love that completely heals. It is beyond all desire, beyond all possessiveness. It is totally beyond all sensation. That is love, which the brain doesn't know. Completeness can only be established within ourselves through the transformation of all the skandhas, the personality. We dealt with this very difficult subject of the skandhas the other day. And now you will appreciate why I tried to consider the skandhas as we did. Potentially, every being possesses the faculty of converting the transient elements of empirical personality, the skandhas make up this empirical personality, into the organs of the profound reality in which the profound reality in which no, not one of the great elements, as they were called in the old days, earth, water, fire, air, none of the great elements can find a foothold. Now, of course, you might wonder, what on earth does that mean? where do earth, water, fire, air find a foothold in us, apart from the fact that we know that the body is constituted of such things? It means that all that belongs to the great elements, any of the elements which are perishable, do not enslave or captivate our consciousness, our awareness, our inner awareness. This is the important thing. See, this is that inner freedom, that complete freedom in deepest consciousness from being bound by any of the elements, the mortal elements which compose the universe of changing forms. The universe as such, the formal universe, is the mortal universe. But this innermost depth of consciousness is the immortal state. When Manas, as the isolative self-consciousness, that is to say, Manas functioning in terms of mano-vijnana and empirical consciousness, changes into the seer of the oneness of life, it is the source of the realization of the inner sameness. The Mahayana texts actually use the term equality, samatha. But I think that if instead of the word equality, we use the word sameness, it will be a little more elastic, inclusive, a little freer word. The sameness of all living beings. See, by using the word sameness, we avoid the superior-inferior aspect of things. If you say equality, I am equal to you, you are equal to me, then we immediately think in material terms of quantity, you see, and so forth. The famous classless society, which is an impossibility altogether. Every single one of us is a class unto himself, because he is unique, and in his uniqueness is different from the other fellow. So there we are. That's why I prefer to use the word sameness. Now, by this inner reversal or conversion, this is one of the deep meanings of metanoia, being converted, Manas becomes the jewel, the money, the consciousness of enlightenment. This first enlightenment consciousness, we can put in today's terms, the sense of transcendence emerges and makes you feel the true aspiration, the transcendent urge towards fulfilling the purpose of our existence as human beings in the world. The realizing of the universe, by the universe, of enlightenment through human beings. Then, desire, which is passion in its meaner sense, kama chanda, passionate desire, and Krishna, tanha in Pali, the thirst for sentient existence, change into, they are converted into dharma chanda. All our desire energy, which is our actual psychophysical electrochemical energy, which is interpreted by the brain in psychical terms, that is tanha, trishna, changes into dharmachanda, the aspiration for liberation. And individual consciousness, the vijnana skanda, you know, the fifth of the group of skandhas, into the knowledge of the universal law and ultimate reality. The ultimate reality, which in Sanskrit we call the dharma dhatu jnana. Dharma dhatu is the ultimate truth, the stuff of truth, if you like to so call it. Jnana, of course, is knowledge. And it is represented by the Dhyani Buddha Vairochana. Those of you who were here last year will remember we had these on the blackboard, and you copied them out, you see. Vairochana, the Dhyani Buddha. This is, of course, personified in Vairochana. Now, all these Dhyani Buddhas are not Buddhas up there or down somewhere else in immaterial spheres. They are all within us. As this change takes place in us, we nominate that change with the name of the Dhyani Buddha. And as I said the other day, this is a term coined by Western scholars, very interesting coinage too, to indicate the embodiment of what is realized within oneself. And Vairochana means coming from or belonging to the sun. You see, doesn't mean the sun which is shining up there, but the sun in a cloudless sky in the mid-heaven, radiating light, intensest light, and the warmth of life. So Vairochana is the illuminator of our lives. That element in us which constantly illuminates our perceptions, our minds, that is represented by Vairochana. And the emblem of Vairochana is the Dhamma Chakra, the wheel of the law. You all know, as students of Buddhism, what the wheel of the law means and implies, and you'll recall that it has eight spokes, each spoke representing the eight spokes representing the noble eightfold path. And its mudra, gesture, is the gesture of the wheel held in his hand, in the hand of Vairochana. He holds the Dharma Chakra, and he is within us. So, the skanda of Vijnana, the consciousness group, is transformed into the knowledge, the dharma dhatu, the jnana of dharma dhatu, which is the knowledge of universal law and universal reality. Thus, our vision is turned back from the world of sense objects, seen and experienced as separate things, to the source, the alaya vijnana, where there is only the complete oneness to unity. A oneness which is composed of, integrally composed of, an immense variety of, which makes up what we call the many. The one is the many, the many are the one, because it is a living interplay all the time. Interplay. It's not as if there is one static object there, another static object here. A living process throughout the whole universe. And that's one of the wonderful, marvelous things of modern science, that it has definitely established this complete interaction and interplay between anything and everything in the whole universe of manifestation. Pursuing wisdom, this is really a case of pursuing wisdom, in terms of understanding the nature of things, science has also demonstrated the actual manifestation of this oneness which is realized in the depths of religious consciousness. That's why I always feel that science is so important. Always has been, actually, through the ages. But we have never appreciated how important it is. Now, when our vision is turned back to the source, the Alaya Vijnana, in which the primordial forms or archetypes, the seeds or germs of all things are stored, then the waves on the surface of the ocean of universal consciousness are smoothed and converted into a shining mirror, as it were, in which the images of all forms, rupa, are reflected undistorted in pristine purity. The waves on the surface of the ocean of Alaya Vijnana. Those waves are caused by us, human beings. Specifically human beings, because it is in us human beings that self-consciousness grows from our primordial animal beginnings. Self-consciousness grows, and it grows as isolative self-consciousness. This is the natural process of growth. There's nobody to blame in this. So we separate things out and keep them apart in consciousness. We are unaware of the wholeness of things. This is how we grow. This is the meaning of Adam's fall. The meaning of the fall of Yima in Iranian legend. There is also the legend in connection with the Rig Veda, in the Rig Veda, in connection with Yama and his sister Yima, but there is no fall there. I won't go into that now because it's a lovely long story and description and it will take up all our time. I mentioned that in the Alaya Vijnana, the primordial forms or archetypes, the seeds or germs of all things are stored. The word Adam also represents one of these seeds or germs. The germ which is Adam, and Adam meaning man, mankind. Therefore it applies to all of us, whatever religion we are studying. that germ has immanent in it the full potentiality of the totality and of transcendent consciousness. That is the germ. This potentiality of enlightenment. The sensuous Rupa Skanda, therefore, the form world, becomes the exponent of the transcendental. Exponent meaning the expressor of the transcendental, and becomes the starting point, in our Buddhist terms, of the experience of shunyata. This primordial void, which is the plenitude, which holds the plenitude within it, the shunyata. And when through us this shunyata comes to fruition, the psyche, the individual's psyche, has become completely empty of all concepts, ideas, beliefs, convictions, and so forth. It has become utterly transparent to the light of transcendence itself. That is the most practical aspect of the teaching of shunya and shunyata as far as the individual is concerned. It's the emptying of the psyche, the denuding of all the fixations that afflict us. We ourselves are responsible for those fixations. What is it that we definitely try to fix? The attachment to what we like and the aversion to what we dislike. Those are the things we attempt to fix in the psyche. Isn't that so? The psyche functions constantly that way. Therefore, it is in a state of conflict. It's in a state where the psyche becomes full of fossils, solid fossils, which obstruct light from going through. Hence, as in the Hridaya Sutra, the Heart Sutra, it is said, form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. Now, in this instance, form refers to the archetypal forms. The archetypal forms are no fixations at all. You see? And these archetypal forms have been represented through the great religions as the angels, archangels, the suras, the asuras, the demons, and all the rest of it. We have misunderstood the whole lot of them. But they hold the truth in symbolical terms. Those forms are the forms which are emptiness, and emptiness has those forms. So, that which is beyond material form becomes conscious through form. In this connection, think of your Ikebana work. That which is beyond material form, Vairochana, the pure radiating light, the illuminating light, becomes form, and the form is the exponent, the expressor of that which is its counterpart, the formless. And I believe I'm not wrong, am I, in saying that this is related to the spirit and activity of Ikebana work. that through the form, that which is beyond form becomes conscious. Thus, according to the Vijñapti Matra Siddhi Shastra, the earlier consciousness is transformed into the consciousness connected with the knowledge of the great mirror. Mahadarshanyana Samprayukta Chitta Varga. Magnificent mouthful. You see, the knowledge of the great mirror, the mirror-like wisdom which represents the forms in their pristine purity, the archetypal forms. And this is the element which is the root source of that power of wisdom which then works through what we commonly understand as the mind and the brain. Now, when the earlier consciousness is transformed into the consciousness connected with the knowledge of the great mirror, the mirror-like wisdom, it is represented by the Dhyani Buddha Akshobhya. Akshobhya is the name given there. And the meaning of Akshobhya is the imperturbable one, the immutable one, the changeless one. But changeless not in the sense of fixation. This is very important to understand. Not in the sense of fixation. Imperturbable, and you may recall yesterday, I think it was, we talked, or maybe on Sunday, we talked about upekkha, that fourth aspect of love as presented in Buddhism, metta, karuna, mudita, and upekkha. That fourth aspect is the imperturbable aspect, the completely poised aspect, not the its first colloquial meaning of indifference. You see, it's the imperturbable one. And this is immutable, it's changeless. It is not going to vary. What is that sonnet of Shakespeare? Love is not love.
When adulteration finds.
Yes. Love is not love which alteration finds. There is no alteration here in this. You see, that's Akshobhya. And his emblem is the Vajra, the diamond scepter, the hard or the mighty one, the Dorje. And then you yourself, with that realization, become the Vajrasattva, having a heart or soul, if you like to use the word soul, of adamant, like a diamond. The Vajrasattva. Now you see how different the meaning of Vajrasattva in the Buddhist teaching is from that in the Brahmanical teaching, where Vajra is associated with the physical element, the thunderbolt. You see? Zeus is the thunderbolt wielder also. And when he hurls his thunderbolt, or when Indra hurls his thunderbolt, it means death. And his mudra, his gesture, is the gesture of earth touching the earth. Right. Now, feeling which is self-centered, as long as manas plays the role of isolative self-consciousness, now turns into feeling which includes all that lives. Feeling. It turns into the consciousness connected with the knowledge of equality. I've used the word which they is commonly used, but I prefer, as I say, sameness. The knowledge of sameness. And in this knowledge of sameness, you will discover an extraordinary thing. When you meet anyone, anyone so ever, if you have really developed this inner depth of consciousness, you will see another version of your own self. Now, do we see another version of our own selves in Hitler or Torquemada or any of those charming folk? But you see, the love that heals is not possible unless we do see that and can see that. Because when we do see that and can see that, then we do not reject the other. If there is any rejection or aversion towards the other, then there can be no healing. Whole making. This was the sort of love that Jesus spoke of when he gave his one and only personal commandment to his disciples before the crucifixion. Love one another as I have loved you. How does transcendence love? This way. It turns into the consciousness connected with the knowledge of equality, a sameness, and you see each one is a variation of any other one. The samatha jnana samprayukta chitta varga, as it is called, into the equalizing wisdom embodied in Ratna Sambhava, the Dhyani Buddha Ratna Sambhava, represented in the gesture of giving, the Dana Mudra. Now, profound meaning of charity, of giving, comes in. And with the emblem of the jewel, Ratna Sambhava has the emblem of the jewel, the threefold meaning of the money, the jewel, is represented in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. For nowhere is the inner unity of all beings felt more intensely than in the emotions of love and sympathy, maitri, metta, in the sharing of others' sorrows and joys, karuna and mudita. With karuna, compassion, one shares completely with the sorrows and suffering of others, which means also the suffering of all mankind, so that one ceases to feel and think in terms of my suffering, my problem, my difficulty. But one sees, this is sorrow, this is problematical, and so forth, you see. And one experiences it in universal terms, involving the whole of mankind. And not only the whole of mankind, but the whole universe itself. Because manifestation means constriction, limitation, the conditioned state. The profoundest meaning I can see of the word jati, translated as birth and mistranslated as rebirth, meaning reincarnation. Now, out of this, there grows the urge to give, not only possessions and gifts, but one's whole self. I want to digress just a moment, and then we'll stop. The meaning of marriage. If one sees into these things and understands these things, then marriage between man and woman means the unreserved giving of one's whole being to the life partner reciprocally, unconditionally. What possibility is there then for the breaking up of marriage, of the dissolution of that which is whole, which is holy? But how many of us throughout the ages have been capable of this unconditional, unreserved giving of one's whole being to the other? The external difficulties will come, the disagreements, the differences of viewpoint, etc., they're all bound to emerge. See? But if each partner really understands and feels love in its true sense, it is quite easy to let that spirit of unconditional, total self-giving come into operation and bring that marriage to complete and perfect fulfillment. This is marriage on earth. But marriage takes place within the individual also. The masculine and feminine elements which compose our own psychical being, when they are harmoniously related to each other and completely accepted by each side within our own selves, that is one meaning again of the marriage made in heaven. Another meaning at a deeper level is when we ourselves, having realized that harmony, put ourselves in harmony with the archetypal energies and forces which run the universal process of becoming and evolving. That is the second marriage made in heaven. And the third and final marriage made in heaven is when you are the completely enlightened, the liberated one, not separate in any way from the totality, which is the whole truth, the reality.